You're listening to KSUT's Four Corners Edition. I'm Mark Dugan. An independent redistricting commission has approved a new map for Colorado's 35 state Senate districts. KSUT's Capital Coverage reporter Scott Franz has more.
If the state Supreme Court approves it, Democrats will be favored to maintain their Senate majority during upcoming elections. A West Slope district that includes the cities of Delta, Montrose, Gunnison, and Aspen would become the most competitive race, according to a study from nonpartisan analysts at the Capitol. A map of new House district boundaries also gives Democrats an apparent edge. Meanwhile, the Colorado Supreme Court heard complaints this week about a proposed congressional map. The court has until November 1st to decide whether to approve it or send it back to the commission for more work. The court has until November 15th for the State House and Senate districts. I'm Scott Franz at the State Capitol.
The nation's top authority on drought has released its operating plan for the next 5 years. As KUNC's Alex Hager reports, the National Integrated Drought Information System emphasizes the need for resilience.
With more than 90% of the Colorado River Basin in drought and climate forecasts calling for a warmer and drier future, the agency highlighted the need for recovery and preparedness. That includes disaster relief programs for agriculture and recreation businesses, and even mental health programs for farmers whose bottom lines are suffering with less water. In the Southwest, drought has resulted in $7 billion of economic loss since 1980. The report also laid out plans to enhance a drought early warning system, which uses complex climate data from around the region to set preparations in motion when times are dry. I'm Alex Hager.
Later during Four Corners Edition, more reporting on Western water issues. Wetland habitats across the West are being impacted by humans and climate change.
We're trying to prevent these systems from disappearing entirely from our landscape.
We'll hear about efforts to restore these riparian areas that not only benefit plants and wildlife, but people too. That story coming up in less than 7 minutes. This is Four Corners Edition on KSUT. Regional author Jonathan Thompson recently released his new book, Sagebrush Empire. It's a deep dive into the politics of San Juan County, Utah. Thompson spoke recently to KZMU Radio in Moab about public lands conflicts. He also delved into the blossoming of the indigenous movement around the protection of Bears Ears National Monument.
Thompson has a long history of traveling the high deserts of San Juan County. He grew up nearby in Durango, Colorado, and began hitting the trails pretty much from birth.
After I was born, my parents started taking me camping over there in Combe Wash and Arch Canyon and those sorts of places pretty much before I could remember, before I could walk probably. Like, that was my go-to place, you know, for the desert. Pretty much still is.
Later, as a journalist, he covered the region, its history of racism, land disputes, and culture clashes between the native community and their white neighbors. In his new book, Sagebrush Empire, he details the long simmering conflict over land, and he begins with an illustrative case known as Gategate.
So Gategate was this kind of incident that happened in 2017. It was a heated time in San Juan County.
Just a few months earlier, Barack Obama had created Bears Ears National Monument after a pretty bitter debate. Soon after Donald Trump was sworn in, it was understood that monument would likely be reduced.
But basically some retirees from Durango, they went camping over in Valley of the Gods, which at the time was in Bears Ears National Monument. And one of them, Rose Chilcote, was a pretty active environmentalist with the Great Old Broads for Wilderness. The Great Old Broads have been very active in San Juan County, trying to kind of curb public lands grazing, trying to deal with ATVs in the backcountry, that sort of thing. And a lot of people didn't like Rose Chilcote in San Juan County. So they went over there. Her husband, Mark Franklin, closed a gate on a corral for reasons that aren't totally clear. Basically, he just did it. But he closed a gate on a corral. They didn't think anything of it. They left. And a few days later, they were driving back past that corral, and these cowboys came and ran out and sort of stopped them from going further down the road and called the sheriff. And they were accused of trying to kill the cattle by closing the gate and cutting off access to the cattle's water. Eventually, they were charged with felonies. They could have gone to prison. And the legal saga actually continues to drag on. And kind of no matter how you look at it, the severity of the charges were a form of political retribution against Rose Chilcote and her activism.
It was just one skirmish in what's been referred to as the Sagebrush Rebellion. It's a fight for control over land that goes back over 100 years and has many iterations and battles. The intensity ebbs and flows. Thompson says cattle ranchers and those fighting for more local control were emboldened after Trump's win, but it's unclear where that energy will go under Biden.
I mean, it's really interesting because when Biden got elected, then he comes in and says he's going to do all these things like restore the national monuments. And so far, we haven't seen the kind of backlash that we saw from Obama. And the reasons for that, you know, I honestly don't know what it is. Like, certainly there's opposition to it. There's some backlash, but it's not as bitter or as angry as it was before.
Although that's so far, the restoration of Bears Ears National Monument could be a new flashpoint. And Thompson has seen a growth in activism on the other side of the fight, those looking to expand federal protection, especially from the Native community.
The Indigenous movement has blossomed in the last really 5-6 years. You know, I mean, it was there. I mean, it's been there since the American Indian movement really in the 70s, but it certainly was revived. You had Standing Rock, you had Bears Ears, you had all these kind of things going on where Indigenous activists were taking the lead and the mainstream environmental groups were kind of following along.
Thompson also has a newsletter covering public lands called The Land Desk. Justin Higginbottom for KZMU News.
Selected articles from Jonathan Thompson's Land Desk newsletter can be found at ksut.org. Just look under the News tab. This is Four Corners Edition on KSUT. Much of the conversation about water in the West is concerned with human use, but it's also an important part of wildlife habitat. Work is underway across the region to make sure birds, insects, mammals, and plants all have thriving places to live near bodies of water. Laura Palmisano from KVNF Radio reports on wetland habitat restoration in the Gunnison Valley.
So on the drive in, you probably noticed that we're basically in a high elevation desert out here in the sagebrush ecosystem.
That's wildlife conservation biologist Nathan Seward, who works for Colorado Parks and Wildlife. On this warm August morning, he's talking to a small group of volunteers. They're here to help with a wet meadow restoration project taking place on public land 20 miles outside of Gunnison. A wet meadow is a riparian area in the arid sagebrush landscape.
Always joke around that I should have majored in basket weaving instead of wildlife management, because that's definitely a skill we're going to be using today.
Volunteers like Peyton Manis weave willow branches into protective barriers. The team also builds with sagebrush and stones collected nearby.
I think it's really cool how we're doing it here. It's super low tech, which means that basically anyone can come in and do it. You don't need a lot of training.
Volunteers hammer wood posts and use rocks to build simple structures and artificial beaver dams along sections of the creek. These structures slow the water down and spread it out. Max Sawyer says a narrow stream creates a very small strip of habitat going through the valley bottom.
By putting these structures in and spreading the water out, we can go from 3 feet of habitat to 10 feet to 20 feet to maybe even 100 feet of habitat.
Sawyer is a master's student in environmental management at Western Colorado University.
The goal of this restoration project is to get this stream to re-wet more of the valley bottom again, spread it out, move it to the edges of our meadow, reduce some of our upland species that have come down, some of that sagebrush, get it out of the valley bottom, get more of those riparian species in here.
Wet meadows and riparian areas in sagebrush country only account for about 2% of the landscape. Trouble for these systems started when white settlers came out west. Instead of taking their wagons through the sagebrush, where it was rocky and rough, they'd follow the edges of the meadows. Conservation biologist Nathan Seward says the wagon wheels created trenches that were reinforced by livestock trailing between water sources, and eventually off-road vehicles using the same paths. These trenches caused water to pool.
And so when water gets captured in those trails, it speeds up and it becomes more erosive. And it starts to downcut. It starts actually washing away the topsoil and working its way until it finally hits the bedrock.
Max Sawyer says these impacts are being sped up by climate change.
So we're trying to prevent these systems from disappearing entirely from our landscape.
wet meadows provide critical habitat for deer, elk, migratory birds, pollinators, livestock, and the federally threatened Gunnison sage-grouse. They also act as natural sponges, holding water in the soil and slowly releasing it over time. Seward says that is only getting more important as climate change makes the area drier.
Everyone knows that water in the West is life. I mean, all life needs water. So by holding more water here in the Gunnison Basin longer and putting it to good beneficial use for wildlife, for our agricultural industries like ranching as well, you know, really everyone benefits from this kind of work.
Project organizers say the restoration is working in the Gunnison Basin. Overall, they've seen wetland vegetation double in treated areas since the program started in 2012. This is just one of dozens of watershed restoration projects in Colorado and states across the West. I'm Laura Palmisano in Gunnison.
This story is part of ongoing coverage of the Colorado River Basin, produced by KVNF, distributed by KUNC, and supported by the Walton Family Foundation. Up next on Four Corners Edition, it's been 1 year since the ignition of what would become one of the biggest wildfires in Colorado history. And scientists and engineers are under more pressure than ever to find new ways of battling such megafires.
It's called the Team Awareness Kit, and it was originally developed by the military to provide that common operating picture and real-time map of the battlefield.
Coming up after the break, we take a look at the latest firefighting technology being deployed from the air to the ground.
Four Corners Edition is brought to you by Spine Colorado and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to Four Corners Edition, a weekly news magazine from KSUT Public Radio. I'm Mark Dugan. One of Colorado's largest and most destructive wildfires started 1 year ago. The impacts of the East Troublesome Fire are still being felt in the Grand Lake area. The fire also raised the stakes for lawmakers and engineers trying to find new ways of stopping future mega fires. KUNC's Scott Franz has more on new technology the state is working on to keep residents safe. He also finds some things are getting in the way.
One of the most powerful fire prevention tools in Colorado is not much bigger than a basketball and is housed at a large hangar at the Centennial Airport. That sound you're hearing is the device being lowered from the belly of a shiny Pilatus PC-12. An airplane that flies high above the state looking for fires no human can see.
So the infrared is behind that big lens underneath.
Bruce Dickin manages the state's fleet of firefighting aircraft.
And then there's a color camera and there's a laser rangefinder in there.
This camera can spot unattended campfires from 25 miles away. And its ability to alert firefighters to small blazes, Dickin says, is a big reason Colorado was not ravaged by larger wildfires despite ongoing drought conditions.
This year we found 206 new fires so far, which is an all-time high for us, right? So fires that nobody knew about, fires that may or may not have become large fires.
But there's only two of these eyes in the sky at any given time, and they cannot see everything. The East Troublesome and Cameron Peak fires were not detected quick enough and grew to record sizes. It's what convinced lawmakers to spend money on a new firefighting tool. It's called a Firehawk, a military-grade Sikorsky helicopter that some credit with saving the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California from approaching flames 2 years ago. That state's governor, Gavin Newsom, has since ordered six more and uses the aircraft as a backdrop for several of his press conferences.
These replace the old 1970s Huey helicopters. These are state-of-the-art. These fly much faster. They allow for more suppression, and they're a lot more safe.
Colorado's first $24 million Firehawk is being built in Inglewood and will not take to the skies until next year. In the meantime, engineers in Colorado have been testing a new technology they say is starting to revolutionize how firefighters battle wildfires down on the ground.
The main technology that we've been working with is an app for smartphones.
Brad Schmidt develops firefighting technology from his office in Rifle.
It's called the Team Awareness Kit. And it was originally developed by the military to provide that common operating picture and real-time map of the battlefield. So I'll just show you a video. This is what it looks like. It's
Schmidt pulls up a simulation on his laptop and shows me how firefighters can view the exact perimeter of a blaze, along with locations of their fellow firefighters in the palm of their hand. Each person, fire engine, and aircraft appear as a small dot. The positions are refreshed every 10 seconds.
They've never had this type of real-time information before, and some of them have been working in fire for 20, 30 years. Typically, they'll get one, you know, map of the fire every 24 hours. In a lot of cases, it literally is a paper map of the fire.
The technology was tested on this year's Muddy Slide fire in Rout County near Steamboat Springs, as well as another blaze in California.
And the supervising firefighters out on the fire line could see where the fire had grown to, and they actually made a decision to directly attack the fire rather than retreating and executing a large burnout operation. And that strategy was successful and actually kept the fire several thousand acres smaller than it otherwise would have been.
But other parts of the state's response since the East Troublesome Fire are not making as much headway.
We're really excited to show you some of the science that we're working on, and we're going to start off out here.
Senator John Hickenlooper visited a wildfire research lab in Fort Collins last month. It included a discussion with some of the state's top scientists and firefighters about how to prevent future wildfires. But it turned into more of a venting session of what has not been working in recent years.
We spent $1 million on 250 homes.
Gary Breese, who leads the state's Association of Fire Chiefs, complained about how expensive it was to clear trees and shrubs from his wooded neighborhood south of Castle Rock.
It's nice to see. It looks completely different. But we've already seen the regrowth.
Federal money has also been flowing into the state for mitigation projects, but Lori Hodges, who leads the Emergency Management Office in Larimer County, says she can't use it.
Because there's too many restrictions on it, and most of those restrictions are based on which lands can you use, what can you do on what lands, and then if you can't get those dollars to agree in different pots, you can't get anything done.
At the end of the roundtable, I asked Senator Hickenlooper what he could do in Washington before the next fire season.
There isn't very much government can do, right? We jump up and down and wave our arms and say, plan, you get rid of the shrubbery, don't have wood shakes on your roof. You know, if you're in the woods, you know, we scream and yell, we spend millions of dollars on average, and yet your heart breaks when you go out and look at one of these fires afterwards and you hear the stories from these families. And there's, at that point, there's not much you can just. Same thing with COVID. So many people now don't want to get vaccines. I'm not trying to start a fight around the table, but you know, it's a free country and we allow people a tremendous amount of freedom, which means that in a sense, they have to take responsibility.
Meanwhile, the state's Firefighting Technology Center continues to test other new methods of stopping fires from getting out of control. This includes a self-driving all-terrain vehicle that could deliver supplies to firefighters. And there are new drones that could one day replace firefighters at dangerous scenes. I'm Scott Franz in Denver.
Well, health officials in the U.S. are advising citizens to get a third COVID shot as a booster. Global health experts are urging people to look at equity in vaccine distribution. Dr. Tapani Dutta is an assistant professor of public health at Fort Lewis College. She gave KSUT's Sarah Flower an international perspective on vaccines. And a quick note, both Flower and Dutta were masked for this interview and may sound muffled at times.
Dr. Dutta, as a professor at Fort Lewis College, how has COVID-19 and this pandemic changed the way in which you teach students about public health from a global perspective?
A very pertinent question, and yes, tremendously, because at one point, the good part is that you had a real example that policy and science are playing out in real time. So we have ready examples of whether we are explaining concepts like global collaborations for global health, or we are explaining concepts like what is the difference between endemic versus pandemic versus epidemic. So there is COVID helps us with live examples. That said, this semester onwards, I am needing to redo many of my, not just syllabuses, contextualizing syllabuses, but also the content of it, but also the methodology to deliver it. Because as you might be aware, that some of the students are taking classes online, some of the students are taking classes in person. The third thing, I guess, is teaching has become much more empathetic, much more understanding, because all of us are going through the same thing. There's nothing like the divisions of subpopulations have been blurred. So if I need to explain it with an example, it is like, as much as we are understanding that students go through these personal crises, livelihood level crisis, the crisis of not being enabled enough with technology, those are the same realities which we as faculties are also going through, which does affect our concentration. But the good thing which has happened, at least for me, what I see is much more empathy has built up, much more truthfulness and honesty to express vulnerabilities. Like, I haven't traveled home, which is India for me, for 3 years now. Now, when I share that with students, it is not just expression or building of empathy and building of relationship. It's also a very direct and live example to explain to them that how your mental status or the other social determinants of health affect your health situation or health crisis per se. I think it has made us better humans than much more empathetic souls.
Boy, that is not always the case in what you hear, especially in America, with the division and what's been happening politically. But that's why I brought you on here, Dr. Dutta, is to talk about equity. I think, you know, right now the World Health Organization is talking about booster shots for the United States. There is so much out there for the United States, while the World Health Organization is saying, please hold. Let's pause that till we get more of the entire world vaccinated. What does this story look like from your perspective as a professor?
First, the aspect of equity. Unfortunately, when we talk of equality versus equity, equity means person who need it, you give things as per the need of the person. So somebody who needs more, you give that person or that country more as compared to somebody. So it's not equal distribution. Unfortunately, in vaccine distribution, we are still looking into the aspects of equality. Has every country got the vaccines, received the vaccines, which the case is very disparate out there. Whereas in the US, as of today, I guess around 55% to 60% of people have been vaccinated. There are several countries, especially in the African subcontinent, where not a single dosage of vaccines have even reached. So there is a huge disparity when we talk about even the aspect of equity in the context of access. Now, access is not the only component of equity. Equity means many other things. Equity means affordability. Equity means understanding things. Equity means access to knowledge. Equity means having vaccine acceptance, and not just acceptance at an individual level, but at a social level also. So here comes the change or the transformation which COVID has brought in as compared to previous immunization or vaccination programs which were going on or which are going on in all countries. Vaccine used to be an individual decision. A person decided whether he or she would be vaccinated and would vaccinate his or her children or not. Vis-a-vis COVID is the scenario, because of its transmissibility, it should rather become a social norm, because somebody else's vaccination actually impacts how much of transmission is happening or how safe the other person is, including family or other members, colleagues. So that shift or that transformation needs to happen from an individual decision for healthcare to vaccination or immunization being a social norm. That transformation has not happened equally across the globe. That does affect equity. Now you also brought into the terms of booster dose. Wonderful, I would say a great advance in science. For the first time we are seeing where science is really advancing in leaps and bounds. But then when we put it in the frame or in the canvas of equity and some of the issues which you raised, which comes why? Because some people have not got it. Some countries don't even know about it. Some people are still grappling with, do I pay for it or do I not pay for it? In that context, a concept of booster obviously now raises those eyebrows of why you, why the US, why where it is being manufactured, people are not getting it, vis-a-vis where the African subcontinent, should it now start manufacturing its own vaccines? The recent Lancet study does mention that booster dose for the Pfizer vaccine, those who had been vaccinated, a booster dose of the same vaccine is available and it's most useful for immunocompromised people. There's a whole lot of confusion for even people who are having access to the booster dose, whether I should or should not take. Whereas the global tug of war lies why you getting a booster dose, whereas there are at least 10 countries in the world where the first access to vaccine is envisaged only in 2023. As late as 2023, the first vaccine might come, if at all it comes. Populated countries like China and India are envisaged that they would be somewhat vaccinated to some extent because they are indigenously manufacturing the vaccines by 2022, beginning of 2023.
This has been a very insightful few minutes. I wish we had more time together, Dr. Dutta, but I would like to for you to close out of any final thoughts or things that we need to add in for our listeners today in terms of global health and global public health, no less.
For local people, I would say this is the flu season coming up. The flu shots are there available free of cost. So people who are entitled, people who have the access to it should get their flu shots. At an individual level, I think very important for us to be empathetic for the bigger world in terms of global health, in terms of understanding that there are several people actually out there who do not have the resources. Vaccines could be a mega narrative which is going on for some time now. Very important, of course, but we need to also think about other things which might be affected. Chronic diseases, immunization of children, education of children, especially primary school goers, that many students are reporting that they have forgotten simple concepts like addition and subtraction in math or reading a foreign language. And with lack of digital technology, there's no schooling actually happening. So I think it is future of children, future of people, lives, livelihoods, all of it put together, a great opportunity to actually practice humanity, which we have been preaching all through.
Dr. Tapati Dutta, Professor at Fort Lewis College of Global Public Health, I so appreciate your time here today and informing our listeners on a much bigger global scale.
You can hear this interview again and read a transcript at our website. Just go to ksut.org. This is Four Corners Edition. The program is a presentation of KSUT Four Corners Public Radio and Tribal Radio. Production staff includes Ken Brott, Stasia Lanier, Sarah Flower, and Lorena Richards. Mark Dugan is senior producer and editor. Our original theme music was composed and performed by Jonas Grushkin. New episodes air Friday mornings at 8:30, and they're also archived at ksut.org. Just look under the programs page. I'm Mark Dugan. Thanks for listening.